This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
This episode is brought to you by Essentia. A better you starts with better hydration. Essentia is on a mission to inspire people to do what matters most. Their proprietary ionization process transforms water from any source into ionized alkaline water, providing water that's 99.9% pure with a pH of 9.5 or higher. Essentia overachieving H2O, the number one ionized alkaline water. Shop now.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code SPOTIFY for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
I mean, one of the things about stigma, people say, well, you wouldn't blame a person for having a broken leg or cancer. Why do you blame them because they're depressed? Or you wouldn't say to someone with a broken leg, just, you know, get back on your feet. Why do people say that to you when you're depressed?
You're listening to the Science Focus podcast from the BBC Science Focus magazine team. We're the UK's best-selling science and technology monthly, available in print and in several digital formats throughout the world. Find out more at sciencefocus.com or look out for us in your app store.
Hello, I'm Alexander McNamara, and welcome to this week's episode of the Science Focus podcast. Mental health has become a hot topic in recent years, with campaigns asking us to be kind on social media and to reach out to friends who are struggling. It seems now more than ever, we have a better understanding of what it means when someone is struggling with their mental health. But despite this, some people feel that the stigma surrounding it still stops them from getting the help they need. Professor Anthony David is a neuropsychiatrist at University College London, and this week he speaks to our editorial assistant Amy Barrett about why this stigma exists and whether it's getting any better.
If you can, just tell me, what is your book about?
Well, simply, it's seven stories, case histories, if you like, based on, you know, patients that I've seen, but it's an amalgam of many different patients I've seen over the years, but where the stories have sort of stayed with me and that have been somewhat extraordinary, and I think make unusual reflections of people's life history. It's only as I was writing these stories, which I hope are of interest in their own right, that I sort of started to see that there was a theme, that it was about something. And in a way, it's about how we are all biological organisms, but we all have our thoughts and feelings, but we're all also part of the wider culture and society. And psychiatrists talk about the biopsychosocial approach to mental health. And it sounds at one, on the one hand, quite technical and academic, and on the other hand, it sounds like, well, it's just a bit of everything, isn't it? It's motherhood and apple pie. But I think by talking about individual cases, you get to see why the biopsychosocial approach is very substantial and quite profound. So there may be an individual going through a crisis, but in the background there may be, you know, religion as a sort of specter hanging over them. They may be caught in, they may be a woman who finds themselves caught in the sort of cultural expectations on them as a woman. They may be someone for whom racism is a sort of ever-present social reality. And so that's kind of happening outside, as it were. That's going on all the time. While for them, it's about their conflicts, their struggles, their individual needs, and how they're not being met, how they're being distorted. And as a neuropsychiatrist, I've got to try and take all of that into account as to what's happening in their bodies and in their brains. Do they have a condition that might be, have they experienced some sort of damage to their brains through an accident or illness or disease? Do they have a condition where the sort of biological processes normally run like clockwork without us knowing? Have they gone awry somehow and that's sparked off difficulties in terms of their drives and motivations? So somehow putting all that together, all those levels together, is what we're doing when we're trying to understand what a person's going through. So by sort of telling the story, by trying to understand what it all means, I'm hoping that people can see the sort of breadth and complexity that goes into not only that goes into psychiatry, but that goes into, you know, our struggle to understand our lives. So that's kind of, if you like, what it's about.
And these stories that you're telling, you know, they're firsthand, aren't they? That you actually meet with patients as a neuropsychiatrist. What is your day like working in the clinic?
Well, it's, I mean, one thing about being a psychiatrist is never boring. I mean, yes, it can be frustrating, and sometimes you have to take the flak, but it's never ever boring. So I spent quite a long time working in a psychiatric hospital. I had an inpatient unit, so I had a ward. So we were seeing kind of the severe end of the spectrum of patients. So, you know, that was quite tough. But I had a very varied sort of week. I'd also crossed the road into the general hospital onto the neurology and neurosurgical wards, where there'd be patients referred because they've got a mental health problem as a result of brain damage or brain injury specifically. So that was a very interesting kind of area. So you, not only was it interesting to be in the territory of, you know, high-tech biomedicine, but also to sort of try and speak up for the mental health side of a person, you know, lying in a bed connected to all the machines and having all the high-tech scans. And then there's just the outpatient clinic. So a person comes to you, there's a letter from a GP or another psychiatrist or another doctor saying, please, can you see so-and-so? There's a few paragraphs, and there you are. You've got, well, we have the luxury of having quite a bit of time, sometimes an hour or an hour and a half on the first meeting, and it could be anything. Could be anything. So my career has spanned all of those things. Nowadays, it's more just the outpatient clinic, but I draw on the different settings in the book to show again the kind of variety and spectrum of people that the neuropsychiatrist encounters.
And when a patient comes to you, say, in the outpatient clinic, what do you need to know about them in order to help them?
Well, there's almost nothing that's not relevant. Usually you'll have just a brief indication of a problem, and obviously that's where you start. And, you know, the best consultation is with you, the doctor, saying as little as possible and the person just telling their story as they find it. But there is a sort of routine and structure to, you know, the way one carries out these assessments. So you start with that, and then you usually then go back to the person's family, get them to describe their family background, their own development and upbringing, and then obviously the sort of current preoccupations like they might have. And it's putting all of that together, making sense of where they are now in relation to what's gone before, not forgetting the things that the individual themselves may not be aware of, illness and diseases and family history, but also, you know, what their understanding is, how they've tried to cope with fears or beliefs or fluctuations in mood or difficulties with biological drives like eating and sleeping, and try and come up with what we call a formulation. So a diagnosis is a kind of, it's a necessary labeling that we have to do so we can communicate with other doctors and so on. But the formulation is a sort of diagnosis in three or four sentences that encapsulates what's the essence, what's going on, what perhaps has led to it, and where we think we might be able to find a route out. And so, you know, that's the sort of core encounter.
Mm-hmm. And you must sort of experience so many different people, so many different problems. What's the hardest situation you found yourself in over your career?
Oh, gosh. There's so many different challenges. And I think accepting one's inability to change a situation, you know, the frustration of that, the impotence of that sometimes in the face of just relentless underlying disease that we just can't change. You know, those are perhaps the toughest things. I mean, sometimes you become the focus of a lot of despair and distrust, you know, individually, so that the patient sees you as the problem. And you're trying to do your best, but it seems like whatever you do provokes more and more anger and resentment. So that's the kind of unique thing that psychiatrists have to deal with. I mean, the worst thing that can happen in the context of psychiatric consultation is, I think, probably suicide. And there is one of the stories in the book does deal with that. And, you know, obviously that is just an unbearable tragedy for the individual and their family and their loved ones. But, of course, it does really resonate with healthcare professionals as well. You know, they often feel incredibly guilty and frustrated and, you know, impotent. It is part of the job in a way. If you're trying to deal with people at their limits and extremis, it's, you know, that's going to happen sometimes, in the same way that if you're a cancer specialist, people are going to die of cancer, and that's just part of the job. But it never makes it easier, and it always prompts you to try and understand things what might you have done? What might have been different? How might we have, you know, alleviated that pain? But so it's a constant sadness, but also a kind of motivator to try and do better, to try and understand more deeply.
You must have to protect your own mental health, though, as well, in that situation.
To some extent, yes. I mean, yeah, you've got to continue. You've got to be able to go on and look after the next person and survive. And I think we're increasingly aware that we have our own needs, but it's more about and being open to sort of feeling what it's like to be bereaved or to suffer to some extent is a necessary part of the job. Yes, you can't allow yourself to be overwhelmed by it, but feeling it at some level is absolutely necessary.
And so is there anything that makes a person more likely to suffer with poor mental health?
Well, of course, no one's immune. It's something that sort of binds all humanity together, our vulnerability or propensity to suffer from mental ill health. But obviously, it isn't evenly spread. And again, taking the sort of biopsychosocial approach, we know that, you know, poverty, deprivation accumulates around people with mental health problems and vice versa. You know, it isn't an accidental connection. And when people's lives are more comfortable and more rewarding, their mental health is better. But of course, we all know people whose lives seem to be perfect, the people who seem to have everything they need, and yet it's not like that for their inner lives. Sometimes things we forget are things like a what's going on in their brains biologically, which the person might not be aware of. Although we don't really understand it yet, there are genes and heritable factors that, can make a person more likely to react in a certain way. That doesn't mean that that's a destiny, but it's part of the picture. And of course, the way that we sort of try and understand and psychologically cope with whatever adversities or successes that we might have, sometimes that can lead us in the wrong direction, and we can end up tying ourselves in knots with expectations and with desires and beliefs that can't be fulfilled. So all of those reasons lead one to becoming vulnerable.
Mm. And what is actually happening in the brain when someone is suffering, and what gives rise to the physical symptoms that most of the patients in the book do exhibit?
Well, obviously the brain is such a complex organ, but we've got to try and we are, I think, getting better at understanding different functions of the brain in terms of the way that our minds, brains are constantly interpreting evidence, interpreting sensations and perceptions. That nothing's coming in like a raw emotion or a raw like a color or a sound. It's never just coming in unscathed. We're processing information from the minute it hits our senses, and we bring to that's in order that we can understand all of these sensations that we're being bombarded with. We've got to kind of package them in a certain way anticipate what's coming. And so that's why we're able to process so much information so quickly. But that also, the side effect to that is that sometimes our assumptions or our expectations are slightly wrong. And so that can lead us to have perceptions when there isn't really a stimulus out there because we're expecting it so much. And in other words, that's a hallucination. Similarly, beliefs that we hold very dear that are part of our sense of who we are, sometimes when information or evidence comes along that slightly contradicts them, we just can't deal with it. And we ignore that sort of information as well. And then our biological drives to eat, to reproduce, to sleep and wake, they're very delicate. It's a very delicate machinery, and a slight twist here or there, and some of these functions can just go excessively or can fail to reach a normal threshold, and that can have profound effects on our behavior, because after all, we are animals, and we are sort of we have a sort of engine room of these biological functions and drives, and they are evolutionary, very ancient, but slightly too much or slightly too little. And we can be driven into what we recognize as psychiatric disorders. They can affect our mood. They can affect our behavior. In terms of physical symptoms, again, the mind and the body are so inextricably linked. You can't really, have one without the other. But again, interpretation is so important. Do we think that a symptom is harbinger of some terrible illness or catastrophe, or do we think that it's just a sensation that can come and go, and that sometimes sensations can, play tricks on us? So a lot of people, it's their interpretation of symptoms that leads them into becoming, very fixated, and it sort of diminishes their ability to actually use their bodies in a healthy way. And sometimes just trying to unravel how they've developed those ideas about the symptoms in their bodies, that they can regain control over them.
So how would you treat something like that? What would you do?
Well, I guess I've been talking about very generalities. Can you be a bit more specific?
Sorry, yeah. So the final example where you said that someone might have a symptom and overthink and read into it something, how do you get a person past that if that's what their brain is telling them?
So if a person's convinced that they have a physical condition which is sort of slightly at odds with what their medical attendants are telling them.
Mm-hmm.
Is that the sort of thing?
That can be
a very, very lonely and painful place. And you perhaps start out as a young practitioner thinking, well, we just need to give the person the facts and tell them they're fine. The tests are all negative or whatever. But you soon learn that not only does that not help, sometimes that actually makes it worse. And it's very much about putting yourselves fully in the shoes of the other person and seeing how, commanding their experiences are, and how that simple information isn't enough to override that. But on the other hand, it is about beliefs and ideas. So that tells you if those beliefs and ideas are enough to cripple a person, in a sense, then they're powerful enough to free them from that tyranny. But you've got to go into, you've got to really understand where the beliefs and ideas are coming from, and try and help the person themselves find alternatives to test different hypotheses. Okay, well, it may be that you feel as though if you were to exert yourself, you're going to suffer from overwhelming fatigue, and that just proves that there's something deeply amiss with your body. But here's another explanation. Let's test that. You know, perhaps it is that you try to do too much and then put strain on your body, having not done anything for many weeks or months. So let's try and do it more gradually. Expect a bit of symptoms, but then press on. And then the person can experience for themselves some sense of improvement or regaining of ability. So it's by understanding the physiology, but also understanding where the person's own beliefs come from, and try and help them to unravel them, rather than simply, you know, trying to browbeat them into giving up those beliefs, because that doesn't work.
And you've said how no one is immune, and you know, we all could be at this point in our lives at some time. Why do you think there is then such a stigma around mental health and having conversations about mental health?
Yes. I mean, I think that is improving. I think we are having more conversations about mental health. And, you know, we're not to be political. All of the political parties up to the election were making various pledges about mental health and improvements in funding for mental health and understanding. And I mean, that's never happened before. So at least it is coming out in the open, and the hope would be that that would reduce stigma. But I think stigma is a very stubborn thing, and it's partly because there's also an ethical and moral dimension to psychiatry in a way that doesn't apply to other branches of medicine. You know, it's about what people, how people treat each other. It's about whether, you know, what your obligations are to try and get better. And often people presume that certain kinds of patients, psychiatric patients, don't want to get better, and that their behavior is about controlling other people, making threats, and so forth. And although those are usually unfounded, that's just sort of a prejudice, nevertheless, it is part of the mix. And so I think it is something to do with the, you know, whether a person has volition and is somehow responsible for the way they behave. So a psychiatrist should never put the person as being responsible for getting ill, in the same way you don't blame a person for having a heart attack or having a stroke. But on the other hand, they have to participate in the process of recovery. Yes, it may be that they've got to take medication and that the medications aren't as effective as we'd like, but it often involves them confronting their previous beliefs and behavior and trying to change it. So it does require the person to participate in a way that is a bit unique. I mean, one of the things about stigma, people say, well, you wouldn't blame a person for having a broken leg or cancer. Why do you blame them because they're depressed? Or you wouldn't say to someone with a broken leg, just, you know, get back on your feet. Why do people say that to you when you're depressed? And the aim of those sorts of campaigns, I think, is to reduce stigma and to say, look, it's an illness like any other illness. But when you speak to people with depression, they'll say, well, it is an illness, but it's not quite like any other illness, because it's about me as a core person, in a way that if I break my leg, I don't kind of feel that as a core person there's something changed about me. So while it's a kind of useful starting point to say mental illnesses are illnesses like any other, it's not quite true. And trying to understand why it's not quite true, why it's not quite people's experience, that if they've had depression and they've had a broken leg, they'll say, no, they're not the same. That's what makes the fascination, I think. And that's what the challenge is for us. And when we understand that a bit better, perhaps then the stigma will start to unravel a little bit.
Mm. And are there any things that I could do to protect and support my mental health? Is it all kind of determined by factors that I can't control?
Gosh, no, that would be a very fatalistic position, wouldn't it? I mean, I think because physical health and mental health are so connected, if you look after your physical health, then a lot of your mental health will take care of itself. Yeah, you've got to try and be lucky. I think nurturing relationships, so that if you're going through a bad time, you've got friends and others who can support you, and that if you offer the same kind of support to them, it's good for them. Plus, you learn a lot about how you are, you know, how you might be more resilient yourself.
And is there anything that is commonly, you know, miscommunicated about mental ill health that you really think needs to be corrected? Anything that you're quite passionate about that our readers or listeners would want to know?
I think as we've said, it can happen to anybody. So it's wrong to think that there are certain people who, you know, are in some way weak in some sense, morally or emotionally. You know, that's really not correct. It's not helpful, and that really should be banished. I also think that sometimes in our attempts to understand mental health and actually, you know, genuinely to see this as something that can affect anybody and everybody, there is a slight tendency to ignore the more seriously mentally ill. So on the one hand, we want to say, yes, this can happen to everybody. You know, it's happening to me. I get depressed or anxious. It sometimes downplays the really, really serious extremes that sometimes people can have. So when they're talking about their own experience that, you know, I'm bipolar or I have autism, that's fine. Yes, it helps understand that we're all of us on a spectrum. But sometimes the people at the real extreme end of the spectrum who aren't telling you about their experiences in this sort of relaxed way, they sometimes get ignored. So one thing is to understand that there are people who are very, very unwell, who need a lot of care, who really need professional help. They need, you know, biological, physical, and social support. We need a lot of research to understand what's going on in the brains and the minds of these people. It's not all just part of life. So, you know, the spectrum idea is very important, but we mustn't forget that there's a top end of the spectrum where things are going on that are very serious, and they you know, they need proper investment.
And in terms of the research that's going into this at the moment, what can you tell me that's being done that's possibly new or on the horizon?
Well, as we've talked a little bit about our understanding of the brain, and, you know, that is just a revolution in science now, the kind of tools that neuroscientists have to understand at a minute level the chemical exchanges going on in the brain, how the neurons develop, how that they form connections. You know, it's the pace of research is just extraordinary. A lot of those neuroscientists don't really feel that they have anything much to contribute to mental health. They're just interested, you know, how the brain works in a way. But I think that they have an enormous amount to contribute. And I think the way that they are sort of learning about how the brain learns information, how it adapts, how it makes predictions, that's going to have a huge impact on our understanding of mental illness. The other thing I think I also mentioned was genes. So we know that certain illnesses and traits and temperament can run in families to some extent. And understanding exactly what the mechanisms are, that's a very active area of research. We know that there aren't just like one or two genes that make you depressed or psychotic. It's usually dozens or even hundreds of genes that have a tiny effect, but accumulatively they can have a big effect. So understanding what each one of these genes is doing in terms of proteins and biological systems and control, and how they're switched on or off by things going on in the environment. You know, I think research on that sort of level in the next 20 years is going to be revelatory.
That was neuropsychiatrist Professor Anthony David talking about mental health. His book, Into the Abyss, in which he tells stories of patients he has treated and what their cases have taught him, is out now. In the June issue of BBC Science Focus magazine, we take a look at the bacteria that can eat plastic, chew through carbon and create food from thin air. As always, there are loads more science stories inside and on sciencefocus.com. And if you like what you hear, let us know with a rating or a review wherever you listen to your podcasts. Finally, be sure to check out our brand new bonus podcast, Everything You Wanted to Know About, where we get the brightest minds in their fields to explain, well, everything they know about it. It's in our feed, so make sure you subscribe and listen as soon as they come out.
Thank you for listening to the Science Focus podcast from the BBC Science Focus magazine team. We're the UK's best-selling science and technology monthly, available in print and in several digital formats throughout the world. Find out more at sciencefocus.com or look out for us in your app store.